Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and I hope that you're noticing that my voice is getting better every week, and I will thank the nice man who pokes a little message in with my packet of coldies when I get it. And if he wants my address to send a check, email me at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. But this program is not about my voice, strangely enough.
You're nominating yourself as a spokesperson for coldies.
For coldies.
You like the cough medicine, too.
Yeah, I like that, too. That had codeine in it.
But hold on a minute. Today we're thinking summertime, or at least fall, and down under all the way to Melbourne, Australia, where they have a super-duper food and wine festival that lasts for 10 days in the month of March. And we caught up with the executive director of the festival, Natalie O'Brien.
Who is so good at what she does. Boy, she condensed a whole complicated event into one interview.
Yeah, so why don't we just have her explain it? Because it's better than us trying to do that now.
Great.
This is getting to be that time of the year when Peter wonders, back when he came to the United States, whether or not it was a really good idea, because it's cold and windy in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where we now live, and the sun is shining and the cherry blossoms are out in Melbourne, close to Geelong, where I used to live. And we caught up today with Natalie O'Brien, who's calling us all the way from Down Under, to talk about a singular event called the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
Now, which I love.
Yeah. Now, when you go back to the days when I first worked in Melbourne, everybody used to say Melbourne was very Victorian, suitably named, because it was about as exciting as a drink of cold water, and the food was worse. And everybody wondered why the city was so popular. Now, if you haven't heard of Melbourne, Natalie's going to quickly explain a few things that you need to know, but the best advice we can get from this end is you ought to go there. It truly is a vibrant, exciting place. But Natalie, put it a dot on the map for us, if you would.
Absolutely. As we spoke about, we're into our beautiful summer season, and of course cherries and wonderful produce. But Melbourne is located in the state of Victoria, in the southwest corner of Australia, and so we're a very compact state, but we're really known for the incredible produce and wineries. So we have wineries in every direction, and so we have many cellar doors to visit, and we really have a vibrant food culture that has really only evolved in the last 25 years.
Now, a lot of that, I think you would probably agree, has to do with the variable population. I mean, the population when I lived there was all from England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales before they went there. Now Melbourne is one of the world's most cosmopolitan cities. So there is Southern European cuisine, there's Asian cuisine, there's lots of that going on. And then it seems the Australian chefs themselves have gotten excited about what they can do rather than just doing the same old thing.
Oh yeah, we have Maud Oz. It just blossomed a number of years ago, and it just keeps going better and better and better. Tell us about that, Natalie.
I think that's so true. In a lot of ways, the festival started way back in 1993, and the food culture that you were talking about was very Celtic. And in fact, I'm about a sixth generation Irish blood, and so it was very much, and we describe it in Australian terms as meat and three veg. And I don't know if you know that sort of saying, is that's what we're having for dinner. And it absolutely is that we had many cultures living in Melbourne, but we, for whatever reason, weren't embracing the incredible produce, ingredients and traditional recipes that had come from generations of different cultures. And one of the other things you mentioned is absolutely true, is because Australia is so far away from some of the oldest food cultures in the world, many of our chefs spend a lot of time around the world embracing ingredients. And these days we're asked the question, what is Australian cuisine? And the way that I describe it in my conversations with farmers and growers and chefs is that we, in Australia, we take the incredible produce that we have here and we're prepared to take a little bit of risk and influence from wherever we've got it from. And so I think the chefs are very inventive and quite often have family heritage that is from another complete culture as well. And it really is this wonderful melting pot of experiences and food from around the world.
Now, what's the name of that wonderful chef in Sydney?
Tetsuya. I'm wondering whether you, Perry.
I was actually talking initially about Tetsuya Wakuda.
He was like number one chef when we were there, and that was an unusual event. But I think what Natalie's talking about is the whole culinary world
has shrunk.
And so that chefs from all over the world go to Australia. I mean, we had Rene Redzepi camping out in Japan, and now he's going to be camping out in Sydney period of time. We've had all the people that they brought in, all the food writers and everybody, to explore even Tasmania, which actually we have a personal connection there, but most people never even heard of it. Even Australians never even went there.
Right.
And now that's on the map, and you talk about great produce and seafood is incomparable.
Now the festivals had a lot to do with this, you think, just because it's been a forum around which people can gather, and it's been an audience that's really big numbers too, right?
Absolutely, and I think you're right. I often talk to arts organisations that may have one artistic director that curates a program. I think one of the things about the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, it's in fact curated by the industry that are here. And you're right, it's a forum. We're a tiny organisation that bring people together. And because we have been around for some time, we're just delighted to get phone calls from incredibly inspiring chefs, commentators or winemakers wanting to be part of the festival and the gathering. And so we like to use that language, is we're coming together as a gathering every March, which I have to say is the most spectacular time to be in Melbourne, Australia, because it's our autumn season, it's vintage, it's harvest, there's incredible produce available, and it's a really lovely temperate climate at that time to be out and about. So I think it feels like it represents the industry, and many of the collaborations are chefs themselves self-selecting people in far corners of the globe who they want to work with here in Melbourne.
Peter has a question, but I want to sneak one in.
Just a
comment is that last time we were at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, Gabrielle Hamilton, who has a restaurant in New York City called Prune, was doing a demo, and I had been trying to schedule her for an interview for On the Menu for a while, and so I went up to her and I said, you know, I've been trying to get together with you for probably a month and a half now, and here I am. I had to come 10,000 miles to get you face to face, and it was true. It was funny.
What a lovely story. And we hope, you know, there are lots of stories like that, like-minded people getting together.
Now, this is a long festival. This is not like the Music City Food and Wine Festival in Nashville where we went recently, which is a two-day event, or the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience, which I think lasts like 3.5 days. You come either for a short visit and a lot of opportunity to pick and choose, or for a time that starts for a total of about 11 days. Natalie, am I about right there?
That's right. So next year our dates are the 4th to the 13th of March. So we squeeze in 2 weekend periods because unlike some food festivals around the world, we have a series of programming in the central city area. But as we spoke about earlier, we have incredibly vibrant countryside that has incredibly strong food and wine content, and so about 30% of our program is in fact in regional Victoria, so we very much encourage people to travel to the source of the food and the wineries to also have a hands-on experience or in fact just a dining experience.
Now tell me about this signature event that kicks it all off called the World's Longest Lunch. It sounds like a rather tacky play on getting a Guinness Book of World Records record, but it's actually much more than that, isn't it?
Look, it's been a wonderful event that started from the very first festival, and really it was the whole idea of conviviality, of people coming together with local food, local wines and local chefs. And in the very first year, it was located at our iconic sports ground, which was the MCG. And each year it's moved around the city, and we've closed roads, we've placed the table outside art galleries and really important icons to Melbourne. So for the last couple of years, we've actually had 1,602, to be precise, who've dined with us at the World's Longest Lunch. And the lovely aspect of the lunch is it also extends out into regional Victoria. So next year, there'll be 24 longest lunches across the state. So people will be in our high country, people down on coastal, beautiful piers, right through to central Victoria. There'll be up to 10,000 people dining at different tables across the state, which we think is truly a wonderful way to start the festival.
And it's not a brown bag lunch of sandwiches and a soda, is it, either? They're going to serve real gourmet food.
It is, and it's in fact, it's the one occasion that we have white cloths, and so, of course, we're in an era of casual dining, but the longest lunches where we do sit down to white tablecloths, the Melbourne-based longest lunch, in fact, is 400 metres of table, and it is the time that we sit down to a delicious three-course lunch matched with local wines, depending on where the location of the lunch is.
So, I mean, it really, the longest refers to the space aspect of it, not the time it takes to consume it.
That's right. And often I'm sure people would like to sit there well into the evening, but it absolutely is about the length of the table in some really stunning environments in Gippsland, which is east of the central CBD of Melbourne, is wonderful dairy country, and there's a fabulous old swing bridge down there, and one of the longest lunches is placed on the bridge, overlooking valleys and beautiful, beautiful countryside. And so that's the other aspect, is that each table is set in a beautifully iconic setting that means a lot to that particular region.
Now here's a problem. They're all on the same day. I mean, I'd like to go to two or three of them. I mean, can't you stagger them somehow? Or
agree with you there. Some of the longest lunches in regional Victoria look so tempting and divine.
Yeah, you want to go yourself, right?
That's right. I have the same dilemma myself. And this year, the Melbourne location for the very first time will be on the Formula One Grand Prix pit straight. So the race is run annually around the same time around Albert Park Lake, which is a beautiful parkland, a very short distance from the city. And we have talked about this for a number of years, but logistically it's been quite a challenge. But next year, on the first day of the festival, we will celebrate our Melbourne lunch on the Pitt Strait. So those people who are interested in cars and racing and food and wine, it's a perfect location for them. But, of course, very, very beautiful setting on the lake.
But if you're into Pinot Noir, then you ought to go to the world's longest lunch on the Mornington Peninsula.
And there's, absolutely.
And there's another special wine event going on there, I noticed, too.
Absolutely. And Mornington Peninsula will, like other regions, create a number of events. So there'll be a world's longest lunch there. They have a lovely race day that will be with local produce and, of course, Pinot Noir famous in that particular region. And I think all of the activities that happen in regional Victoria are really about the people and the personalities and the wine that's particular to that particular region. So, yes, I'm going to find it very difficult. I think I'm going to be based in Melbourne, but there are some spectacular other events in regional Victoria.
Now, there's another one going on. One of the reasons I mentioned the Mornington Peninsula is there's a special event that's sort of like a drink-off between Mornington Peninsula Pinot Noir and Oregon Pinot Noir here in the United States. And we have, of course, a sentimental favorite, but you've got some pretty good ones going there too, right?
Absolutely, and I think it's really funny talking to the wine industry because they call us Melbourne Wine and Food Festival, and of course when I'm talking to chefs, the words are reversed, and I love it. And so wine is a really important part of our programming, not only the local wine, and there are some exquisite local wines and huge diversity of terroir and varietals, but we also like to celebrate, and of course we're very much looking forward to having a contingent of Pinot winemakers from Oregon. Of course, as you say, we also love competition in terms of a lovely opportunity for visitors to the festival to taste and compare and have some good vibrant debate about the qualities and differences between the wines. So in addition to that, we also have some Bordeaux winemakers making their way across to Melbourne for the wine program. And then the other thing that we love to do in wine program is also have food and wine matching, and we call those perfect match. And we don't just stick to a fine dining matches. We love to do some street food match with some ciders and beers, and in fact different varietals of wine as well. So the wine program, whether you are attending activities in the city or in fact heading to the wineries themselves, is a very important part of our programming as well.
Now you have master classes and various presentations as part of this. And what about, can you mention some of the, you have a lot of celebrity chefs coming. Could you mention some of the personalities that the attendees would encounter?
Absolutely. So each year we scour the world for the most inspiring and interesting talent. And of course that means a variety of potentially cooks, Michelin and top 100 chefs, etc. And so we've been delighted to have many of the great chefs and presenters and cooks from around the world over our 23-year history. Next year we have some really interesting talent. We have people like Pierre Kaufman.
That's good.
Who has been here once or twice before, and he really seems popular in the early days of our programming. Of course, you know, training Tom Atkins, Gordon Ramsay, Pierre White, and so, you know, really one of the legends of the industry. We're also looking forward to welcoming the Risotto brothers, Christian and Manuel from Italy, and we're going to revisit risotto. They come from a prolific rice growing area in Italy, and they're inspired by many generations in their family, and they're going to come and share their secrets on risotto, which I think is really fun. Then we have someone sort of closer to home, Mei Chow from Hong Kong, and you know, Mei has got a little restaurant called Little Bao, which opened in 2013, and it's one of those places where people line up eager to get in for her burger style bows, and so she's trained in top restaurants in Hong Kong. So again, some diversity in the program. We're also looking forward to Paul Cunningham from Denmark. We've had a long tradition of having Danish chef Rene Redzepi's first visit to Australia was as a guest of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. He came one year and he promised to come back with a plane load of chefs from Denmark, which in fact he did 2 years later. And, you know, we really enjoyed, and I think that's one of the great things, is actually having an ongoing partnership and dialogue with, you know, incredible people that have visited us for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
Now, there are some top local chefs participating too, right? Neil Perry, you mentioned we interviewed him the last time we were there about his place that was up near the casinos.
In Melbourne, yeah.
Yeah, Philip Mouchel, who was an old favorite of ours, was practically next door in a restaurant that I think must now be closed. But he's a great favorite of ours. But there are some others. Can you mention just a few of those names?
Absolutely. So as you say, Philip Mouchel, an incredibly classic French-trained chef. He will be doing hands-on classes for the festival. Tony Tan, who is a Malay Chinese, will also be doing a hands-on class. A young chef here in Melbourne called Adam De Silva, who has Indian heritage, crossed with Celtic heritage.
That's unusual.
Has
yeah.
a couple of restaurants, one called Coda and one called Tonka, and he will be doing a class as well, and so his inspiration is some of his family heritage that will be part of it. Chefs like Guy Grossi, who are part of the Italian chef community, Guy will be preparing all of the food for the world's longest lunch, for example. Of course, some of your listeners might know Ben Shuri from Attica. Ben will be welcoming from the States Danny from Mission Chinese, who will be coming for one very, very special night. We are very excited about this. Both boys will be
he'll
on the watch.
He'll stir it up, I will tell you.
One of the things that, little known, that Ben Shuri actually loves to make fried rice, and he is truly excited about closing his restaurant to open it up to work with Danny for one night only as part of the festival.
Natalie, is this one of the International Chef dinners?
Yes. That absolutely is one of the dinners.
Something we should stress there, because I noticed, I looked at the program I think yesterday, and the sign sold out already existed.
Yeah, I was going to say people better get on the web.
Some of the international dinners. So listeners, if you want to give your friend or sweetheart a delightful experience next March for Christmas, you better get busy.
Get
your tickets now.
Exactly. And I think what's so wonderful is that the audience are really discerning and picking the things that really mean a lot to them. And that's why the program is diverse. I mean, one of the other things that I'm looking forward to, we have a guy called the Moo Man who comes from in England. And the Moo Man started out really trying to send some messages out about the supermarkets, and it really has ended up with this kind of almost this like emotional story about his relationship with his cows. Yeah. And next year we're celebrating dairy, which is an important export and production here in the state of Victoria, and we're looking forward to the Moo Man, who now has a global following for his movie and the stories of his relationship with his, his very important cow. So we're looking forward to meeting him as we show his film, but also talk to him about life on the farm and, the food security and a whole number of interesting issues as well. So we're looking forward to welcoming him as part of the program next year as well.
Well, you sound excited, and you're getting me excited. Could you give us the website where people go to get their tickets?
Absolutely, Anne. Melbourne Food and Wine, A-N-D, foodandwine.com.au.
That's very cool.
And there is a whole lot of delicious treats from anywhere from sitting down and relaxing, enjoying a dinner, to something more educational where you're actually getting your hands on and cooking alongside some of the world's great chefs.
If you go to OTM in Pictures, there's a picture. Which, surprisingly enough, there's a picture of Peter wearing his Akubra Australian assembled straw hat in Federation Square the last time we were in Melbourne in 2008. I had just bought it in a hat shop in an arcade, and they gave me a deal. They said, are you 60 years or older? And I said, yes. So they gave me $10 off. How about that?
That is terrific. And I think I know where that shop is in Port Phillip Arcade.
There you go. It's probably still there, right?
It's hats.
Yes. So this is not just a festival worth exploring. This is not just a food and wine experience. This is to get to know one of the world's more charming cities. If you're into shopping in arcades, it's there. If you're into cricket, it's there. If you're into wonderful parks, it's there. Melbourne, Australia is on our horizon, we hope. And we hope, listeners, that you'll be inspired as a result of this conversation with Natalie today. To get yourself down there as well, even though we know it's complicated. We know it takes a long time. We know it costs a little bit of money.
That's why we're doing it early, so you have a chance to do it.
You have a chance of saving your piggy bank. And Natalie, we really appreciate your starting your day, because it's Wednesday down under, and it's Tuesday here, and we've enjoyed talking to you, and I hope we'll be acquainting ourselves together in person come March.
We warmly welcome you, so thank you very much for the opportunity.
Natalie, thank you. It's been a delight.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Rabbit O, could you explain what you did by pulling two interviews coming up next from the past? Well, it's hard to believe that we have such a trove of archives.
Well, it's interesting because we talked with Natalie, as you would have observed in, you would have heard in our last interview, about some of the star chefs who've created what it is that today some people call Mardars and some people call it a variety of different things, but a whole new exciting cuisine down under. And I thought it would be fun to go back to 2008, the last time we were in Melbourne for the festival, and draw on the resources we had there, because two of the people whose names Natalie mentioned in the interview, Philippe Michel and Neil Perry, are two of the handful of people who really drove the development of modern Australian cuisine. And it's really interesting to hear what they had to say. I listened with fascination because it's still relevant, you say. So much of what they talked about is relevant. I wish I could have run another 10 minutes on Australian Wagyu.
Yeah.
but I left that out in the interest of time. But I'm sure you'll find these characters interesting, and I hope if you decide to go that you'll go out of your way to make sure that you meet them, as we did a few years ago, and we're so glad we did, and now it gives us the opportunity to bring them to you all again.
For On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Don't forget to email us your thoughts at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Well, you know, it seems, Rabbit, that this is Old Friends Week, because we have a long history, not only with the Donovans, but also with our next guest, Philippe Michel.
Who is widely rated among people around Australia as one of Australia's best chefs, probably the best exponent of modified French cuisine for Australian ingredients.
And a decent, wonderful human being.
And we had the chance to catch up with him at a restaurant venture, which for him is about 3 years old, in the Crown Casino Complex on the south side of the Yarra River in Melbourne.
Bonjour. We are now we're having a reunion of sorts with a dear old, not old chronologically, but we've known for a long time, We were at the Brasserie by Philippe Michel in Melbourne. And it's been a long time since we've seen you, and a long time since we first met you. Hello. Bonjour, Philippe.
Bonjour. Yeah, it's been a long time, I think, maybe 6-7 years, maybe more.
In 2000, we were at Bocuse.
2000, yes. Yes, we opened Paul Bocuse in 2000. Yes, I remember, yes.
Now, you've been around. You are France-born in Normandy.
That's correct. Yeah, the country of good cream, good seafood, and, of course, good Calvados.
Love Calvados. And you've cooked in Asia?
I cook in Asia. First, Mr. Bocuse sent me in Tokyo, where I spent 15 years in Tokyo. I spent 4 years in Hong Kong as well. So, yeah, a few years, we can say that, a few years in Asia, yes.
Now, when we first met you at the restaurant Bocuse, you were cooking Bocuse's food with Asian twists.
Exactly, yes. The recipes were mostly, not the recipe, the influence was Paul Bocuse. You know, I worked 25 years for Paul Bocuse, so it's like having a stamp of Paul Bocuse. Yeah, you cannot forget the man like that. So I have a big influence on Paul Bocuse. But because, like he always said to me, say the success of the chef abroad is to use the local produce, which I did, and to make sure you please the customer, to give them what they want. So even having an influence with Paul Bocuse, I was still trying to use a small twist, trying to use some spices or some Asian influence.
And your presentations have always been gorgeous. You know, the one thing I always think about Paul Bocuse is his truffle souffle that I burn my mouth on every time.
Yeah, the truffle soup is, of course, is a classic of Paul Bocuse. You really have to be careful when you eat it because it's very, very hot, yes.
No, it was soup, not the souffle. I just had a crust. Because you break the crust. And anyhow, well, now, after, that was a long time ago, you moved on to the place where we saw you last in Melbourne, which was?
That was Langton's. We opened Langton's, and I stayed 4 years in Langton. And then from there, I moved again 2 years in Tokyo. I don't know if you remember, but my wife is Japanese, so she wanted to go back to see her family. So we stayed 2 years in Tokyo. And then I decided to come back and open the brasserie in Melbourne again.
Now, I'm looking around, and your decor and the ambience is so French. Could you describe a little bit what your concept of this brasserie is? And, by the way, how does the brasserie differ from a bistro?
Okay, the brasserie, I will call my brasserie a brasserie gastronomique. It's between a fine dining room. It's not quite a fine dining room. It's between a fine dining room and a bistro. A bistro will be very casual, no tablecloths. For an example, no tablecloths on the table, and the food will be inexpensive. The service will be casual as well, still professional. And a brasserie will be a step better, maybe. We will have, like we have at the brasserie in Melbourne, some tablecloths. The service will be a little bit more attention in the service, and the food also will be, even without being too expensive, like a fine dining room. But the produce will be carefully chosen, and we still be using some offal as well, like kidney. We will do a cassoulet, maybe we will do bouillabaisse and choucroute, but it's not quite a fine dining room.
And there's no Asian, this is pure French, no Asian influence in this, except you said you like to keep it light.
I keep it light. My Asian influence at the brasserie maybe will be keep it all the dishes light, free of too much cream. Actually, we don't use any cream in our cooking, except in our pastry, of course. And the sauce will be more like jus, reduced jus. So this is a French brasserie, but with a contemporary touch, I would say.
Now, I'm looking. You have a blackboard with your specials. Just mention for our listeners some of the specials for today.
Okay. Our special, like this, this week, we have some maroon. They're not maroon like chestnut. They are maroon are the crustacean?
We call them Mikey.
Okay, Mikey. And they're from, the one we have are from Kangaroo Island, which in South Australia. But the clear water crustacean, so a little bit sweet.
They're blue.
They can be blue, they can be red, a bit of two or three colors, yes. And green as well, actually. So that's one of the specialty. What else do we have? A pork belly, which is a confit or pork belly. When I say confit, I say confit because it's cooked for 18 hours, very slowly in the oven, so it doesn't dry out. What else do we have? We've got the maroon. We've got the okshik. Okshik is, it's very popular actually now in, around the world. And I think I was the first one to introduce okshik in Melbourne when I was at Paul Bocuse. Even if it's not a fine dining room ingredient, we used to cook okshik and beef tenderloin. And I think I was the first one to introduce okshik. And now okshik, I mean, everyone is cooking okshik.
Our favorite, we had in Spain, we had pig's trotters stuffed with ox cheek, didn't we?
Yeah, it's a fantastic a piece of meat when you cook it very, very slowly. We cook our okshik for 24 hours in the oven. It's a slow cooking. And it's fantastic. And this one is even better because it's Wagyu okshik.
Oh, wow. Now, we have also your menu here, and you do have some really classic dishes. You have escargot. You have, what do you have? Oh, you have all kinds of shellfish, of course, oysters. I mean, it everything looks so good. It's a bigger menu than I anticipated, though.
Yes, it's quite a big menu. Maybe some people will say too big, but I like to work with what's available on the season, what's available in the country. And you know, I like the customer to have the choice as well. And I think they've got a lot of choice. There is, like you said, there is shellfish, there is fish, there is meat, there is beef, there is lamb, there is duck, there is chicken, there is everything. Like a bit like a brasserie in France, you will have different cut of meat, different meat, different fish, shellfish. So it's a little bit of everything, yes.
Well, everything you make is good. I mean, why else have we followed you through all these restaurants all these years? Listeners, absolutely put this on your Melbourne map. Where exactly are we and what is your website?
Yeah, the website is www.thebrasserie@philippemouchel.com.au, and we are located in the Crown Casino in Melbourne, and the address is 8 Whiteman Street, South Bank. Very easy to find.
And Peter wants a word.
Well, there's another tip for you listeners, because last evening we had dinner at an excellent restaurant where the chef was a pupil of Chef Philippe Mouchel. So I think it would be a smart thing to do if you're dining in Melbourne, or even if you're dining perhaps in Sydney, to ask, did you ever work for Philippe Mouchel? Because if you do, I think that will be a stamp of approval. I'm guessing that makes you feel pretty good, Philippe.
I'm very proud of it. I'm sure you're mentioning Anthony Ross from the Langram Hotel. Anthony used to work for me at Paul Bocuse. I've got a few chefs around the city and even out of the city working, who used to work for me and who are doing very, very, very well.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your contribution. And that's the deal, listeners. If it's somebody's been through Philippe Mouchel's kitchen, you can be sure it's good.
And with that, I think it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and
Who would it be? Who would it be on the menu other than Ann and Peter Haig?
Exactly. After a while.
after a while, it gets sort of repetitive. But,
it does.
Anyway. Talking about landmarks in modern Australian cuisine, absolutely one of the founding fathers, although he certainly doesn't seem old enough to be, is Neil Perry, original restaurant in Sydney called Rockpool. Now changing his formula somewhat, and we caught up with him at Rockpool Bar and Grill in Melbourne, a concept that he's going to be moving back to Sydney. And we talk about all that in an extensive interview that's coming next. I'm sure you'll find it fascinating.
Neil Perry is called the father of modern Australian cuisine. Neil, you don't look old enough to have fathered an entire era.
Well, I've got quite a few children, but I'm not sure about an era of Australian cooking. But I am 50, so I've been around for a very long time in the period, I guess, of where Australian food has really changed.
I just decided, so how many children do you have?
Oh, I've got three.
Well, that's not. We interviewed a chef who had four boys. That's a lot. you brought up the subject is, what was, let's call pre and post Neil Perry. What was Australian cuisine like before you hit the scene?
Well, I think there were a number of good cooks, but I think that the Australians' preoccupation with food was minimal compared to what it is today. The quality of the produce was not as good. The variety was not as good. And a lot of chefs like myself over the last 30 years have really worked with growers and fishermen to increase the quality of the ingredient. And also people like myself and Chong Lu and, two or three of us really started to bring Asian flavours into Australian mainstream food, which had not really been done before. Philip Searle was another who did that. And I think together in the early 80s and through the 80s and early 90s, the three of us really pioneered that sort of light Asian flavouring and seasoning and cooking techniques that have now become much more mainstream cooking.
Of course, we were living here in the early 70s, and it was grim.
Yeah, in the 70s it was grim, but I mean, there's always been pockets of good food in Australia. My father was a brilliant cook and used to be a fisherman and a gardener, and he was a butcher, so we had awesome produce, and I think it was him that taught me a lot about that. But now, of course, exponentially Australian food, the quality of Australian food has grown with many more immigrants coming to Australia. I mean, particularly the Asian immigrants that came after the Vietnam War and after the closure of the White Australia policy, and now a lot more Vietnamese and Thai and Chinese and Koreans and Japanese call Australia home. And, of course, they bring their produce with them, and a lot more Middle Eastern people. And so, like America, being a country born of immigration, we have a very multicultural cooking style.
Now, you had a series of restaurants. You cooked in a series of places, but your first really big, iconic restaurant was Rockpool in Sydney, which I have to tell you, we actually ate at 8 years ago.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's the restaurant that's probably defined my style. And that's where a lot of people say that if there is a kind of modern Australian cuisine, that's where, along with a few other restaurants, it was born, and a lot of people have been inspired by that. I just tend to think that I was cooking my food, very produce-focused. As I said before, a lot of Asian influence, but a lot of Mediterranean as well. But cooking my food, not imitating, not cooking other people's food, not cooking classical French or Italian or Thai or Chinese, but cooking a food that I really loved, inspired by all of those.
Now, I always associate you with fish, but you're in a transition phase where you've embraced both fish in the current incarnation of Rockpool Sydney, and also beef, where we are now in Rockpool Bar and Grill in Melbourne. Could you just talk a little bit about your concepts?
Well, I think the reason that at Rockpool I started working with fish very heavily was back in 89 when I opened Rockpool. I wasn't really that thrilled with a lot of the meat growers and a lot of the meat wholesalers, and I wasn't really happy with a lot of the game birds and things that we could get. Over a period of time since then, I've been able to build a great list of suppliers of people growing and rearing produce. But importantly, I've always wanted to open a steakhouse because my father was a butcher, my three brothers are butchers, so meat kind of runs in the family. And I've always harbored a desire to do it. And I understand a lot about meat from my family. And this was a great opportunity. I saw a brilliant site here, 200 seats, so it's a big restaurant. And to me, I just sort of straight away thought, well, this is my steakhouse. And having opened it, it's been brilliant, actually.
Describe where we are.
We're in Melbourne in what is called South Bank, I guess, in Crown Casino and Crown Towers, the hotel. There's a number of really great restaurants that are coming down here now. I've got Nobu next door, and Guillaume, a French friend of mine from Sydney, is coming down. And also the two Italian boys who own Icebergs and North Bondi Italian are coming down and opening up a great restaurant, Robin Morris, and they are terrific restaurateurs. So, yeah, and Philippe Michel. So we've really got a great little precinct of terrific restaurants that have got skilled cooks and really high-quality restaurateurs. So it's great. Lots of people are coming down.
Well, talking just before we started recording, I was so impressed with how much you know about meat, including the artificial insemination of various beets.
Sure. Well, it's really important to understand the mechanics of it, I suppose, and it starts with breeding program, and it starts with what they eat and where they're reared and what breed they are and how they fatten and how they're killed and how humanely they're killed and then how they're butchered and how they're aged and then finally how they're cooked. And that doesn't matter what you're talking about, whether you're talking about fish or you're talking about meat or vegetables. I mean, a paddock or a sea-to-plate approach is one that all great chefs or all good chefs take, because if you don't understand it from start to finish, it's very hard to deal with it and get the best out of it.
Now, you are aging how many pounds of prime beef on your property?
Well, we've got here 5,000 kilos, so what's that, nearly 10,000 pounds of beef. We usually like to get it on at about 35 days dry age, and we go up to about 45, 50 is about the longest we hold it, and we have a number of different cuts, and we also dry age Wagyu, which is really unusual. I buy whole bodies of Blackmore, which is the best purebred Wagyu in the country, or whole blood Wagyu in the country. So it's quite interesting when those 500 kilo bodies roll in every month. It's a sight to see.
You mean they roll in whole and you butcher them on the premises?
Well, they're actually in quarters. I wouldn't like to sort of chop their heads off, but they're interesting because they're such large carcasses to handle. You know, normal yearling beef in Australia would be a carcass weight of about 260 kilos, and these Wagyu come in between 450 and 500 kilos, so they're big animals.
Where do they grow them in Australia?
Our ones come from Victoria, so it's a local product for us. It's about, they're actually bred about 40 minutes out of Melbourne, near Wantirna and State, and then they go up to finish their feed lotting is in the high country, up near the snowy mountains. So they actually are just beautifully looked after from the moment they're born. And we find with any kind of animal, no matter what we're dealing with, if we look at humanely reared, humanely slaughtered, well-treated animals, we end up getting better flavor, better taste, better texture. So very important.
I'm looking at this menu. Could you just skim through and mention to listeners the kinds of dishes that you're doing here?
Sure. Well, because of my love of seafood as well, it's the kind of steakhouse that does great fish as well. And I always find sometimes that steakhouses do good steak, and that's about it. Whereas all the side dishes and all the pasta dishes are all handmade on the premises, and all the fish comes in. It's all line caught. It's all beautifully handled. And importantly, it's actually dry filleted. So to come and have a sashimi of tuna or foretaste of the sea or some live scallops out of the tank that are shucked and served live, basically, they're moving still. If they had a heart, it would still be beating. And if you closed your eyes and tasted them, they're so sweet. You just wouldn't believe how amazing they are. Nutty, sweet, long length of flavor. They're one of the greatest things you can eat.
I might try those, although I had a hard time at a real classical sushi place where he wasn't kidding about live clam.
Oh, yeah. I'm not really that big on in Japan, they eat blood clam and love it. I'm not really a big fan of blood clam. I find it too tough.
And you've traveled a lot in the Far East.
I've traveled a lot around the world. I've been very lucky. I've been working for 11 years now with Qantas.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
When Origami Luggage got in touch with us, I think we really thought it was not really a coincidence that we were thinking of a long trip where we'd have a lot of packing to do. But it really turns out to fit very well into this program, because if you're thinking of going down there for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, you'll certainly need to pack a lot of clothes, and the Origami Luggage system is just the ticket you'll need for just that kind of packing adventure, right, sweetheart?
Yes.
So if we go, we'll be taking our origami bag, and you should too.
Welcome to On the Menu Radio, David Cowell, all the way from Portland, Oregon. How are you this fine day?
Well, I'm fine. I'm excited to talk with you and your audience about our new product, Origami Luggage.
It's really amazing what you've done. It sounds so simple, and yet it's not. And I want to describe it this way. Of all the years that we've been flying on airplanes, nobody has yet figured out a convenient way for people to board and disembark. Nobody's ever figured it out. I don't understand why they haven't. But you took on a somewhat similar challenge, which is how to make packing a suitcase when you're going to travel. How do you make it easier to pack and easier to unpack? Where did this idea come from in the first place?
Well, that's a great question. I collaborated with a longtime friend, his name, Rick Kristen, also of Oregon. Rick and I have traveled together for various pursuits, cycling, skiing, etc., and also our families have traveled together. Rick had the experience of the challenge of finding things that he had packed when he was on an adventure to Crater Lake in Oregon, a beautiful mountainous site I'm sure many of your listeners have been to. And in that experience of being in a cold, dark tent, trying to find things he had packed in his duffel bag, he thought to himself that there must be a better way to organize the things that you are taking on your trip, pack them, and then find them and use them as you are on your adventure. And so Rick and I began collaborating about 2.5 years ago to develop this product idea that was in our minds, and also begin working on our company and the type of company we wanted to be as we entered into a luggage business. So
now it's called Origami, spelt with an E instead of an I, O-R-E-G-A-M-I, for a particular reason. Do you want to address that?
Sure. Well, we we all are from the wonderful state of Oregon and have, for the most part, lived our entire lives here, myself, Rick, my business partner, Jamie Dull. We are all longtime Oregon residents, and that's a big part of it. There is a spirit about living in the state that we live in and the way that we approach our lives and the things that we do and the places that we go that might be called Oregonian-like. In addition, we wanted to be able to make ourselves a unique company in the world of luggage brands, and as it turns out, we were able to secure copyright protection, if you will, for our unique name, so it made sense to find something unique and different that also sort of resonates with ourselves and people, and people seem to like the name.
Now, here's a test for you to prove that you're a real Portlander, a Portlandonian, or whatever you call it. How do you know how the city got its name?
Well, that's no. I feel like I'm failing here. No, I don't know that, Peter.
I think it's interesting. You really ought to know that. Apparently, there were two guys who were in what was called Stumptown, and they had a bet about something, I forget what it was, and the prize was that they got to name the city after their hometown. So one of the guys was from Portland, Maine, and the other guy was from Boston, Massachusetts, and I guess we can figure out who won.
So, well, I've always wondered about the two Portlands and the fact that on different sides of the country that you'd have the unique name, but that makes a whole lot of sense.
Well, that's the reason why. Now, it's really kind of a different thing that you've done. And let me explain why I realize that. We actually have two or three suitcases that are called packing cases.
Mm-hmm.
So they have some organizational component inside.
You mean the Tumis?
Yeah, the Tumis, exactly. So, for example, when I pack one Tumi, certain things go on the left side. When I pack the other Tumi, things go on the right side. But it still doesn't solve the problem of how you actually go about the packing and unpacking process.
Sure.
And how you can essentially unpack without unpacking. And these, I think, are the concepts that lie behind your origami luggage. So tell us more about those ideas.
And bring up also the whole concept. Origami, obviously, is folded paper. It's a Japanese style of making all kinds of unique figures out of folded paper. And you have this concept of unfolding compartments built into your luggage.
That's... Very, very accurate, and thank you for pointing to the key that really makes origami luggage as unique and functional as it is. There are three packing trays of very high quality and durability and versatility that are inside our bag, and those trays are linked together in a very unique way. And by grasping the green pull tab on the top tray and pulling it towards you out of the bag, the trays unfold out of the interior of the luggage. It's that unfolding process that is the unique and almost magical quality of an origami luggage. In almost an instantaneous action, as you pull that green tab towards yourself, you reveal all of the contents and now have access to those items in almost instantaneously. And in fact, that is exactly what our U.S. Patent Office has recently allowed for us and for origami. It's that magical moment of opening up the three trays in a simple, quick action that reveals and gives you access to everything that you've packed. And that is what has never existed inside a piece of luggage that makes it so easy to pack your items, plan out what you're taking, travel with them, and then access them as you... go about your travels. That's the magic.
Yeah, you don't have to remember where you put anything because you can see in the top because the top of each of the trays is mesh, right? So you can see through, and if you can't remember what you put in there, there's a very good chance you can spot it through the top.
Exactly right, and that very quick motion of opening the cases, everything is. And then the reverse is equally magical by grasping the red pull tab and pulling the trays back into the case. You've now almost instantaneously closed your luggage in a neat, simple motion and are ready to zip up your case and move on, or perhaps take your case and move it to the side of your room and get it out of the way for the day. It's just a wonderfully fast and easy way, like you said, Peter, of really never needing to unpack as you go about your travels.
Well, now here's the other clever thing that you didn't even mention, but that I spotted right away, because we have a house with several floors, and most of the clothes are on floor three. And obviously they exit the house in a suitcase on floor one, and the challenge is always to figure out how much and where to pack. With origami, what you can do is you can actually zip apart the three trays, and you can pack them one at a time, and then you only have to assemble everything when you're ready to exit the house through the front door. So you've made a major piece of progress for me, because right now the system is Anne packs and brings what she needs packed to the second floor. I bring the suitcases to the second floor, load them, but I still have another floor to go down.
Hey, David, have you noticed what a nutcase he is about packing? I'm terrified.
I do it a lot of times.
Because you insist. I'm afraid that I'm going to have to be supervised in making sure that all of these things go in exactly the right places. You also have a great number of zip pockets. So how do you decide what goes in there? Peter will decide what goes in all of the zip pockets. Then I won't be able to find any of them.
Yeah, that was the other thing I was going to. That was the other thing I was going to come to next, because you have zipper pockets in various different places. Did you have in mind a particular, you know, the passport goes in this pocket and the so-and-so goes in this pocket and the so-and-so goes in this pocket?
To a degree, I think there are some logical applications or uses of the pockets that we offer. There are several long pockets on the exterior of the bag that are sized to hold a variety of things you might more quickly want to get to, magazines, your travel documents, etc. While on the inside, there are certainly a wide range of pockets that are sized perhaps for shoes.
That's what he was worried about, is where do you put the shoes because of the weight of the shoes. Is there a weight and balance issue involved?
No, we've really not found that. I think one of the goals that we had from the outset was to build a bag that was really a very, very good quality. This is a bag that when you have it and begin to use it, you'll almost immediately recognize that it's very well made. So with regards to balance, I would say, Anne, that the hardware that we picked, the wheel set, for example, is extremely durable and well built. It uses a very smooth rolling skate type wheel, which in fact is user replaceable. If there ever came an instance where an issue occurred with that wheel, but the structure of the bag, all the parts that we use really do, I think, lend to a very easy bag to roll through a hotel lobby, to your campsite, through the airport, etc.
Now, this is a line of luggage, and the one we have is a, I guess it's called a wheeled duffel.
It is. It's our medium sized rolling wheeled duffel. It is of a size and weight that really lends itself towards checked luggage if your travels involve flying. If you are perhaps going on a trip via car or tour bus or RV, it's certainly something that is of the appropriate size to be stored, you know, in your in that type of vehicle.
What else is in the family, David?
There are two other bags planned for this series. There will be a carry-on sized piece of luggage appropriate for as many airlines overhead bins as possible. It's a bit of a moving target these days with many airlines making decisions.
Oh, yeah, what are you doing about that? That's really difficult, isn't it?
It's an incredible challenge, really. In time, as the brand and products continue to develop, we'll certainly offer carry-on sizes that have a little bit of difference. We understand that the international traveler is particularly limited by some airlines, so we'll get to that point soon, but by the spring of 2016, we'll have our first origami carry-on sized luggage for purchase, and then beyond that, we will have a large sized expedition rolling bag for those who are taking longer, more involved trips, either by car or perhaps adventure travel trips with more gear to be carried and more travelers involved to, you know, remote locations. So three bags in the touring series are planned at this point.
And you're going to change the colors because people use luggage as fashion statements anymore.
Absolutely. And, you know, we offer two colors at this time. The black, of course, is hard to beat. It's certainly the most popular color in luggage, while at the same time we recognize people do like to have choices. We have a wonderful fossil-colored bag, which is copperish, brownish, with a little bit of silver mixed in. It's beautiful.
That sounds cool, yeah.
It's an excellent color. So, in fact, it's so far has actually been more popular.
Because everybody is getting tired, I think, of the black.
Sure.
You can't ever find your luggage on the rack.
Let me make a suggestion, by the way.
Yes.
Our most recent Tumi, but a Tumi that replaced the Tumi that I had for 25 years, which was a 20-inch rollerboard, stackable in even the tiniest overhead compartments.
Yes.
We bought a replacement, and I think it was only because this particular model was on sale, but it has an expansion in the top.
Yes.
And I find that enormous. I never really had a suitcase like that before, and it's really amazing when I convert it from a rollerboard to a piece of checked luggage, which I do because I don't like stuffing luggage in the overhead compartment. But that extra 2 inches of space helps you out. It will help us out, for example, next when we're heading for England for Christmas, and we will be carrying more going over than we will coming back, we expect, because some of the gifts that are going to be included in our luggage are quite large. So that's a kind of a really handy thing to have, and it may be something that you'd like to think about in your own line.
I'm sure you're going to go through all kinds of changes and developments because this is the first one, and then you're really taking off with this. Who exactly do you plan on marketing it to? You're a marketing pro from a long time back. So what is your projected audience? Not just sports people, which you are.
Very, very good question. So our approach to developing products and then taking them to market is driven by what we call our groups of travelers. And at this point, we're focusing on three different types of travelers. The first traveler group is an activity-based traveler group. Let's say you're a cyclist and you do summertime tours with other cyclists, or in the winter you're a skier or snowboarder, or perhaps you're a bird watcher and you're interested in taking an extended trip to Central America for that. The key point is that your travel is really driven by your activities. So that is one key group, whether it be sporting activities or other type of activities. You're a activity-based traveler. The second group of travelers that we're focusing on are the group travelers. The group might be a family. It might be a family who's headed to Hawaii, or a family that's planning a trip to Disneyland, a couple traveling with a group, a more traditional group tour. The point being, you are a part of a group, and there may be one or two or three or even more members of that group traveling, and therefore the way that our bag can be organized and distributed and easily managed among people in your group is a great advantage. And then the final traveler group that we focus on is the professional traveler, somebody who really travels a lot, either for work or for their own pleasure. They're people who are spending a lot of time on planes or in cars or trains and then ultimately in hotel rooms, et cetera, and they know how to travel. They do a lot of it. They have a process for packing, for going about traveling to their destinations, doing certain things when they get there, and the inherent features of our bag for, let's call it, the pro traveler, we feel are just so appealing. So, long answer to a short question, we are making products for three different types of travelers: activity-based travelers, group-based travelers, and professional travelers.
Now,
does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, we fit into that third category, I think.
Pretty much,
and we, it will be interesting. We'll have to have another conversation after we've
had,
after we've had the bag for about 3 months and we figured out the particular adaptations that make my life easier.
I have one more question: is who do you? Because I think this is a way of positioning this luggage for listeners. Who do you think is your major competitor in this market?
I would say that of the product that you can purchase from our website today, you're likely to compare it to products from Eagle Creek, to perhaps products from Travel Pro. Our products are not as extensive as Tumi or Victorinox, but in terms of the quality of materials and the parts and all the things that go into making the bag, that was our goal, to build a product that was, let's call it, better quality luggage, certainly not the value price luggage that you might buy, you know, through TV shows or, you know, at national chains.
Right.
The product is a better quality piece, but we always wanted it to be the same price as those better quality brands, but have something inside it that was different, that nobody else had. In other words, we didn't want price to be something that was a barrier to buying something that is brand new and unique. We wanted to be right there with all of those very good quality brands, but have something that was different.
Well, David, I think that it's exciting. I feel like we're at the beginning of this story, and it's going to, excuse me, unfold.
Exactly.
Well, it's time to finish this interview off.
Yeah, but I think maybe you should give us you do sell it from your website?
We do. It's origamiluggage.com. Again, OREGAMI luggage.com. And it's currently available and there's a great promotion for the holidays with a 20% discount and freight included, shipped to your door. So,
wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, go for it, David. Thank you. Thank you very much for talking with us today. I'm sure there's going to be a line of On the Menu listeners who are going to want to try this just like we are looking forward to on our next trip. Thank you so much, and we wish you and your partners the very best, and I'm sure you'll be very successful.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you, Peter. I appreciate that very much.
Thanks, David.
And there you have it, a bonus program today. So we ran a little longer than usual, but we're sure you found it very interesting. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.